All right, everybody, we're going to get started. Okay, well, welcome back. You guys have survived this long without going to the beach, so congratulations. Yes? Unless you went this morning early and missed our early sessions, I guess. All right, so we're going to get started with our next session in just a moment. We're really excited for that one. It's called Out of This World. We're going to talk a lot about space weather, and also Artemis is also involved in one of the presentations, so I'm excited about that. But first, I'm going to toss it over to Erica here for just a quick moment.
Thank you, Danielle. My name is Erica Groce. I am the Professional Affairs Commissioner, so the broadcast board, the planning committee for that, that's in the Professional Affairs Commission, the Station Scientist Committee as well. And I also, in my day job, I work with the National Weather Service Public Affairs. The Space Weather Prediction Center is one of the centers that is in my beat, right, that I cover all the media relations for. I've been with the Weather Service for about 6 months, and I can't tell you how much I have learned about space weather in that short amount of time, and I feel confident that if any of you in this audience are interested in learning more about this, kind of decoding some of the stuff that you see online, you will be able to grasp it, learn it, feel confident and comfortable sharing it with your viewing audiences as well. And I just have a couple things that I want to mention before I introduce our AMS president briefly. You may have heard that the final in the GOES-R suite of satellites, which is GOES-U, is launching in just about a week and a half at Kennedy Space Center on June 25th. The big innovation with that is relevant to this particular discussion. It is called a compact coronagraph that will be on the payload of GOES-U. That will enable us to image sun's corona, the outer atmosphere of it, almost constantly, whereas today it sometimes takes us as long as 8 hours to get an accurate view of what's going on the sun's corona. It brings it down to 30 minutes or less. So this is a huge innovation. So if you want to do a story about that leading up to the launch, you know who to reach out to. Let's see here. In addition to Out of This World, you'll also hear from space weather experts tomorrow at the Joe Witte Station Scientist session and at the NWS National Center Showcase tomorrow. So without further ado, I'd like to just briefly introduce the AMS president, Anjali Bamsai.
Hello, everybody. This is my first broadcast meteorology conference. I feel like I've been in the circuit. I've attended many AMS meetings, but mainly from the R&D side. So I've been on those climate variability and change and tropical meteorology, etc. But I've learned so much this morning because I feel that the last crucial mile, taking the forecast, taking the early warning that we have, and getting it to the communities out there, you're doing such great work. So I just want to commend you all and thank you for doing this for, in terms of saving lives and minimizing damages, et cetera. So thank you very much. I noticed on the program agenda that the first broadcast meteorology conference, it was called something else, I believe, was in 1957. So your community has known the value of this work for a long time, and so 51st one, I guess. So I think we must have skipped some in the middle. Maybe it wasn't an annual event, but I want to thank you for all the work that you do. And then I want to say that we have the awards, the AMS awards, and being part of it now on the inside for the past couple of years, I want to say that we want to see your community recommending and putting in the nominations, because I think you need to get kudos also from the AMS community at large. So please take that extra time off. I know you're all busy. You're there in the front line, and something's happening somewhere in some part of the country. But do take a moment off and put some noteworthy applications and nominations there. There are several. I can't compete with the previous speaker. I was really in tears but there's this June Bursey Meteorology Award for broadcast meteorologists, etc. So please take a moment off And also the final third thing I want to say is that I hope I'll see some of you do come for the annual meeting, but I hope to see more of you there. The next meeting will be, I think, the week of January the 12th, and hope to see many more faces there. Some faces are familiar to me from watching from my living room, you know, when there's something that I need to pay attention. We had a tornado in Gaithersburg, Germantown, last weekend, and I was watching it. So, yeah, thank you very much for all that you do.
All right, so I'm really excited about this next presenter. This is Ryan Decker. He works with NASA from Marshall Space Flight Center, where I live and work, Huntsville, Alabama. And the presentation he's doing is about how NASA accounts for weather in design and operation of space launch vehicles for the Artemis Mission Campaign, SLS, being built in Huntsville. So really excited about that as well, of course. So take it away, Ryan. Thanks for being here. He is presenting remotely for us.
Yeah, apologies. I'd like to have been in attendance with everybody, but unfortunately, I'm now a manager and I have like a ton of work to do, and I wasn't able to get away. But I appreciate Danielle reaching out and, you know, asking to hear a little bit about what we did and the support that NASA does in terms of weather and how we account for weather in the design of SLS, Orion, any of the manned space flight vehicles that are part of the Artemis mission. So I'm going to go in, kind of give you a little bit of background about how that, how we account for it. And then we'll go through, kind of talk a little bit about the Artemis 1 mission itself and the perils to which Artemis 1 endured throughout its lengthy time on the pad at Kennedy, and then talk a little bit about launch, and then wrap it up with what is coming forward in the next several years now with Artemis 2 mission. So what you have to account for in the Artemis mission programs is that we call it natural environments. It's weather is the generic term, but we refine it and call it natural environments. And natural environments have to be accounted for through either the design of the vehicle, or it could be through the operational mitigation, or just accepted as a risk. Because these are restrictions that impact the development or operations of flight vehicles. And so we account for those in our design specification documents, where we define those environmental parameter limits, whether maximum min values, spectra, or model inputs, assumptions, model options, so on and so forth, for all of the Artemis mission programs. That is Space Launch System, Orion MPCV, Human Launch System, HLS, and as well as the XEVA suits for when the crew leave the vehicle and do lunar sortie missions, as well as the follow-on to ISS, which is known as the Gateway Program. So we define all those environments that are used in those programs. So when they account for those, and so we can either do it through those three things, vehicle design, operationally mitigated, or accepted as a risk. If you cannot account for those in your vehicle design, then you go through and you do operational mitigations that you impart onto how you do your processing of the vehicle, so that you can either prevent from operating outside those conditions during your operations. And there are several ways that you can do that. So there are what were known as operational maintenance requirements and specifications. For example, for the integrated vehicle, you will look at fatigue life assessments of like the booster or core stage hardware while exposed to the wind environment during pad stay. So there's There's the range of wind environments that the vehicle can withstand, are they've decided to limit that. And so in order to protect for that, they implement these ORMSs where they measure the winds continuously, and if they exceed any of those limits, then they stop operation or they roll back. And I'll get into that a little bit in the next slide. And so in order to protect the vehicle. Another example of an OMRS is for the launch abort system on top of Orion. There's solid rocket motors that have operating temperature ranges that they can only operate within. And so they record the ambient temperature at the pad to determine if the average temperatures are within those design operational limits. Those are some of the different ORMS examples. There's also what we call launch commit criteria. The launch commit criteria are rules that are given to the launch weather officers at the Space Force that they monitor during launch countdown operations to ensure that the vehicle launches in acceptable weather conditions. Several of those examples are for the integrated vehicle. There's liftoff wind limits to protect the vehicle from pad tower recontact during ascent. The first 5 to 10 seconds of launch, the vehicle actually does not have any steering commands, so it launches vertically, and so it is susceptible to winds because there is no steering active at that time. So we have in the bottom right corner of this slide here, you'll see a compass direction where a solid black line represents the wind limit for peak ground winds for launch that the launch weather officer will assess. Another example is the it's the precipitation limit. You must not launch if in the event there's virga rain or visible rain, virga, or radar reflectivity that's greater than 80 dBZ. They want to protect the thermal protection system from collecting any water that then would freeze and expand and potentially loosen some of the foam and cause debris during ascent that could impact the vehicle. Another that I think is a little bit more common is the lightning launch commit criteria. So there's lightning protection because the vehicle was not designed to withstand direct effects of lightning. So they've incorporated lightning launch commit criteria to protect the vehicle from launching into unfavorable conditions or favorable conditions that would that could result in triggered lightning. The range and from a historical perspective, they did lose a vehicle back in the 80s. It was Atlas Centaur 68 that actually had a triggered lightning event that resulted in a loss of command steering to the vehicle, and they had to self-destruct the vehicle. So the range has a set of lightning launch commit criteria to protect vehicles that aren't designed to withstand direct effects of lightning. And then lastly, there's a space weather proton flux limit to protect vehicle hardware from degradation and single event upsets, which could result in component failures. And this is an example of some of the products that SWPSE provides that the launch weather officer uses to monitor the proton flux environment prior to launch to provide a go-no-go decision on the space weather environment for certain parts of the mission itself. So, and then a caveat to those LCCs and OMRs are what we know as flight rules, and those incorporate various natural environments data to evaluate vehicle constraints during ascent or descent. And so one area that we do at Marshall Space Flight Center is we perform a function known as day of launch iload updates, and that's a process that we use day of launch, atmospheric environments, in the design and verification of the steering commands for the first stage guidance system through during ascent. And so we actually use instrumentation at the Eastern Range. This is a picture here in the upper right corner of a 48 megahertz Doppler radar wind profiler that takes continuous measurements of the atmospheric winds from 2 to 18 kilometers, so from 6,000 to 60,000 feet, that we use to develop design steering commands on the vehicle based on the day of launch environments to reduce the amount, to reduce the loads and trajectory, reduce the loads on the vehicle so that they can fly with it, they can fly without exceeding any of their trajectory constraints. So, and then in the event that you can't have a design or operationally mitigate those environments, if there's a likelihood of encountering them that are deemed small, the program can just accept them as a risk, and they do a probabilistic risk assessment to understand what the cause and likelihood of that would be, of encountering those environments would be. Okay, so going into Artemis 1, we actually started the rollout of Artemis 1 back in the spring of 2022 and went through a litany of problems with liquid with the liquid hydrogen leaks. And so we had a lot of problems with hydrogen leaks at the quick disconnect of where the feed line goes from the ground to the vehicle. And so they had a lot of problems. And so they decided back in late spring to roll the vehicle back to the VAB for repairs. So that was good. It was a good decision, but at the same time, it also brought in the potential for the vehicle to be exposed to the 2022 hurricane season. And so when they finally rolled the vehicle back out to the pad, they still had some additional scrubs due to some other issues. And so that kind of led into the late summer, early fall window where hurricane season starts to ramp up and starts to become an issue in the central Florida coast. So we finally got through, had a good successful tanking test on the 21st of September, and then Hurricane Ian started to form in the Southern Caribbean. And so the mission management team started meeting and started to make considerations for a launch attempt on 9/27 prior to the hurricane. But there was also some other plannings that they were struggling with, so they had to start considering rolling back due to the strength of the hurricane. And so they had a lot of considerations that they had to make: rollback loads, wind exposure, risk of crawler transport failure, so on and so forth. So they finally decided, based on the strength of the sustained and peak winds for that region, that rollback was the best thing possible. So they rolled the vehicle back, and then and that was a good decision, because when the storm actually moved across central Florida, even though it was downgraded to a tropical storm, while it was going along the Central Florida region and through KSC, they actually did observe sustained and peak winds that actually exceeded the steady state and peak wind design limits for the vehicle. So they made the right decision. And also during that time, Kennedy actually reported 17 and over 17 inches of rain during that. So that was a good decision on their part. And you can kind of see here on this side whether or not to ride it out or roll back, that they actually made the decision as the forecast track from the actual track from the forecast actually did bring it right along the Central Florida, you know, across Central Florida along Kent and just to the south of Kennedy.
Hey, Ryan.
So, yes, how much time do we have?
Yeah, we're about a minute 40 over, but we really are enjoying the presentation, but I just wanted to let you know we're a little over. So.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll try and make this quick. So I'll go through Nicole real quick. You know, again, the same situation occurred. They had to, like, make a decision. They actually, for Nicole, it was a little bit different because the peak and sustained winds weren't forecasted to exceed design limits. So ultimately, the decision was made to ride it out, which was verified in that the sustained winds actually were lower than what the measured winds were actually lower than the design limits, and so they made a decision there. So ultimately, they rode it out and then and successfully launched November 22nd. And then had a successful mission. So for Artemis II, just a little bit of background on Artemis II. We have this mission is going to confirm that Orion spacecraft systems with a crew of four that work as intended for deep space missions. They're going to test the range of capabilities, and they're going to do some additional tests and evaluations of the heat shield during reentry. So there are a couple of updates for launch weather related items. They're reducing the on pad wind stay exposure duration down to 120 days, and they did revise the liftoff wind placard to actually allow for higher winds from the north to provide them with a higher launch availability. So that's they're going to have a improved launch availability with this updated liftoff wind LCC. So I'm sorry it went a little bit long. I didn't have my timer on, so I apologize for that. But are there time for any questions or?
Well, I was going to say we are a little bit over, so okay. If you wouldn't mind, you have contact information on the screen that people can take a screenshot.
Yeah, so if we go back to the beginning, there's my email address.
Okay.
You can reach out to me, ryan.k.decker@nasa.gov.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Ryan.
All right. Thank you. I apologize for running over.
Ryan, would you be able to unshare your screen?
Yep.
Thank you.
I think I can. If I do that. Did that kill it?
He's still there.
Yes, you're good now.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so up next we have Kelly Beatty. He is from Sky and Telescope magazine, and he is going to be doing a presentation on understanding and explaining how the sun works.
Thank you very, very much. Oh, it's always a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank you for coming. We've had quite a year, right? We had that eclipse thing back in April. Some of you, I think, probably missed that. And then we had those awesome auroras, right? We're going to be learning a lot more about space weather today and a little bit tomorrow. And I don't know what to follow up with, but I have a taste for you, a tease at the end of the talk here. So, we're going to talk today about the source of all that space weather, which is the sun. Now, I brought Here's a couple of pictures. This is a picture of the sun yesterday. And those numbers, those sunspots are what are called active regions. You're going to learn some terms here that I hope you can use if internally, if not on your broadcast. Active regions are the places on the sun where all of this stuff happens. And they get numbered sequentially. This was yesterday. Oops, I'm sorry. I got ahead of myself here. Okay. And this is the, you know what? I don't think it overwrote. I uploaded a new version. We'll see. This is what the sun looks like. That previous version was the sun in visible light. And this is what the sun looks like in X-ray vision, if you could use X-rays. These are all from NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory. It's a turbulent place. There is a lot going on. And that is all driven by what's going on inside. The sun's core is a balmy 27 million degrees. And it's that temperature and the pressure down there that converts hydrogen into helium, or more precisely, protons into alpha particles. And in that process, every second, 700 million tons of the sun gets converted into pure energy. Now, it takes that energy a while to come out from the inside, literally, unbelievably, roughly 100,000 years from the time that that energy is generated in the core until it reaches the photosphere and gets radiated off into space. And it goes through a couple of major sections called the radiative zone and the convective zone. The convective zone is what I want to talk about here, because that is overturning. Literally, the sun is churning just below its surface to get that energy delivered to the outside. And that process, I want you to imagine a pot of boiling oatmeal that's bringing heat from the bottom of the pot to the top. That's what these granulation cells are here that you see. This is real time. And each one of those is roughly the size of the United States. So it's a very large set of features. Now, that's one kind of convection. Here's another kind that you might not have realized. This will be familiar to you as kind of a Hadley cell, right? Where it's moving from the equator to the poles and back again. And so this is like a 22-year cycle that drives this circulation. So that's more activity on the inside. And then finally, what really gets the sun wound up literally is its differential rotation. And by that I mean that at the equator, the sun takes about 24 days to go around, but at the poles, it's a sluggish 34 degrees. Now, the entire sun is a plasma, and so it's very strongly magnetized, this plasma. And so as a consequence, as the sun differentially rotates, those magnetic field lines, which are accompanying the plasma, get wound up like a watch spring. Tight, until they actually start to become unstable and they percolate through the surface in that last panel there that you see there to create what are called sunspots. This cycle of sunspots, you might be familiar with, it lasts 11 years. This is a trio of images starting with about a decade ago. You can see, I know they're kind of small, but the sunspots are very, very numerous on the sun. And then in 2020, there were no spots on the sun, and now we're back into the fat of the solar cycle. This is solar cycle 25. This is this 11-year cycle that has been tracked for a couple of centuries now. And this is a plot showing going back in time, back to the 1870s. It's a little bit involved, but the point is that the sunspots come and go, and the sun's activity, its dynamic activity, comes and goes with that 11-year cycle. Now, back in 2019, solar physicists got together and created what was called the consensus prediction for how strong this ongoing solar cycle would be and when it would occur. And by their estimation, it wouldn't happen until mid-2025, and it would be relatively weak as these solar cycles go. But by 2023, it was already obvious that things were happening faster and stronger than had been predicted. And so they had to revise their prediction. Down there, the blue curves are where the original prediction, and the red and green curves are, the red curve in particular, is where we are now. The solar maximum for this cycle, this 11-year cycle, is going to happen within the next few months. So I would expect more solar storms, more auroras through the end of the year and the beginning of next year. So let's talk about those sunspots a little bit. They are literally imperfections on the surface of the sun. When I'm showing people the sun through my telescope, I say they're like freckles. They're kind of like imperfections. These are places of intense magnetic activity on the sun. And for those of you who have long hair or know someone who has long hair after a shower, you know, as you're combing your hair, right? Everything's great until you hit a tangle, a snag, and then the comb stops. That's what a sunspot does. It inhibits the energy flowing out from inside the sun. And as a consequence, those sunspots are cooler by quite a bit, by 3,600 degrees over the temperature of the rest of the solar surface. Now, they're still hot. They're still giving off light, but it's a contrast effect. We see them as dark because they're so much cooler than the rest of the sun. Sunspots, as I said, are places of intense magnetic activity. It's where the magnetic field lines are erupting out of the photosphere, kind of like leaping dolphins and going back down. And in the process, they can get very tangled. This is where these active regions are. This is where the explosions come from, the flares come from, generally in the active regions. And so this on the left here, you see an arc of filamentary material that is tracing the magnetic field lines. And so here's the really first important take home that I want you to have today. That is that this plasma, which is the sun, and the magnetic field lines are joined at the hip. The plasma can't go anywhere unless there's a magnetic field, and the magnetic field follows the plasma. If the plasma is pushed out, the magnetic field's followed. They are together. They're one and the same. Okay, here's an impression, a model fit of one of those several of these active regions and the magnetic fields coming out from them. It's a very potent thing. Now, these active regions are sometimes, you can see one there to the right of center, that dark area is something called a coronal hole. It's a different animal. It's a place where there is no complexity in the magnetic field, and the magnetic field lines are basically pointing straight out into space. And so the solar wind, the escape of the sun's atmosphere is very linear and smooth, no complexity there. And I just wanted to show you one to make sure that there's no confusion. These magnetic fields, though, are tight and complicated, and this is where all the action is happening at these active regions. So this is both taken yesterday. That's a magnetogram showing the magnetic field of the sun comes in pairs, a north and a south, and that's sunspot pairs, and the matter coming up from the sun arcing over these sunspot pairs follows suit. Why these eruptions happen, why these solar flares happen, is still a matter of some debate, but I brought a prop. I make no claim to this. You can use this yourself on air. Imagine a magnetic field line that is stretched, and then something pinches the two magnetic field lines together and releases the energy. Right? It's called a magnetic reconnection. And it's that release of magnetic energy that propels all of that matter out into space. It's a very powerful technique. This is an artistic impression of what that might look like. So these flares, this is your second take home. Flares are often X-ray events, like you see here. Those are emitting relativistic particles and X-rays traveling at the speed of light. So a flare, like an X flare that you see from the Space Weather Prediction Center, takes only 8 minutes for that energy traveling at the speed of light to reach from the sun to the Earth. Okay? That is an X-ray flare. That is not the same as an eruption of material, which can also come from those same active regions. That is like a shock wave that's being propelled out into space. Think of it as a space hurricane hurtling toward the Earth. So our spacecraft, I need to set this up a little bit. Our spacecraft are monitoring the sun constantly. This is showing one of these coronal mass ejections going out into space. The white circle in the center represents the sun. The black disk is a mask covering the sun, and everything outside it is being recorded. So this is what a coronal mass ejection looks like going off to one side of the sun, right? It's a blast wave that travels up to maybe 800, 900, 1,000 miles per second away from the sun. If Earth were in the direction of this, it would reach us in a couple of days. But it's off to the side. We're not in the line of fire. If you see one of these CMEs that is, on the other hand, kind of like a blossoming flower going all the way around, right? In that case, it's heading right toward the Earth. And that's the kind of CME that you want to pay attention to, because in a couple of days, it's going to be reaching us and creating solar storms. Now, some of you may have heard of this Carrington event. You know, we had a really serious coronal geomagnetic storm just a month or so ago, in early May, and it was the strongest one for the last 20 years. These are all gauged against the granddad of all solar storms, called the Carrington event, which took place in 1859. This is showing a comparison of, in black and white, the sketch of the sunspot group at that time, compared with that big sunspot group that was crossing the sun. It's not the only time we've had events this strong. In 2012, in September of 2012, there was an ejection of matter recorded by one of our spacecraft, Stereo A. Fortunately, Earth was not in the line of fire. What you're seeing here is an impulsive CME traveling at 2,000 miles per second. At that rate, it would have reached the Earth in about 12 to 14 hours. Much, much faster, and we would have been in big trouble. Fortunately, it was off to the side. It did not affect us. But statistically, we should get these very, very strong, potentially damaging solar events about every 40 to 60 years. Now I'm about done here. I just want to give you a couple of leads for places to go to get information. The Solar Dynamics Observatory is a fantastic resource. There's the website there up the upper right-hand corner where you can get movies and daily pictures at all these different wavelengths to show you what's going on. And then another one is the NASA's Heliophysics Gallery. It has a very long URL, so I've abbreviated it there up in the upper right-hand corner so that you can get to it quickly. And I just want to close by saying this is going to be a pretty good year for the meteors in called the Perseids in August. There'll be a first quarter moon out, but it should be pretty decent on the nights of August 11th, 12th, and 13th. And then finally, here was my tease. You heard about it here first. There is a comet in the sky that you can't pronounce. It's Suxin Chan, ATLAS. ATLAS is an acronym for a robotic observatory in South Africa. It was discovered last year. It is coming in toward the sun. It's going to pass closest to the sun in late September and reemerge in the evening sky. The prediction is that it will be bright enough to see by eye. The hope is that some scattering of the dust would allow it to be actually very pretty and visible by eye. So I hope that you get a chance to see that. We'll have more on that later. You'll have to just watch Sky and Telescope for more information. And with that, I want to thank you very, very much for your time.
All right, we have time for one question. Anybody have one question? All right.
Great. I stumped the class. All
yes.
Right.
Thank you so much again.
All right.
All right, Sean. Come on up, Sean. All right, we've got Sean Dahl here. He's going to tell us all things that we need to know about the Space Weather Prediction Center.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here. I'm great and glad to be here. I am the service coordinator at the Space Weather Prediction Center, which falls under the National Weather Service. What is the service coordinator? Well, if you know what a warden coordination meteorologist, that's what I do. It's our equivalent of that. I'm glad to be here today because I've been wanting to reach out to the broadcast media world, and we've been doing a lot more lately, to make you smarter about space weather so you're comfortable talking about the things you just heard about. So fortunately, I don't have to explain anything now, right? You know it thanks to me. I can just talk terms, and you're going to know what I'm talking about. But what would we like to see from the Space Weather Prediction Center? You all have a great relationship with the National Weather Service as a whole right now. You broadcast the message to your viewing audiences, and the nation get a lot of their information, if not most of it, from you, taking what the National Weather Service puts it out and getting it out there. We're set up the same way. We don't have that ability, but you do. So we would love to see more information about space weather so people get a chance to see something like the Northern Lights that maybe they'll never see again in their lifetime because of that extraordinary storm we had back in May. So with that said, what would my vision be for maybe a quick 90-second or so snippet on space weather in the broadcast media world? I'm not a broadcast meteorologist. I don't have that background. I do have a background in meteorology, so I speak your language. But so forgive me for my faux pas, but let's give it a quick try here. All right, now turning to the sun. It's currently littered with many sunspots on the sun, including two massive regions to the northern and southern hemispheres of the sun right now. If we focus in on the southernmost one, region 3664, we can see the dynamic changes going on. It's become many times the size of Earth. It has grown in complexity, and it's become an increasing source of concern for space weather forecasters about the chances for solar storms. And indeed, it has been erupting with solar flares, those blasts of energy from the sun that immediately affect the outer atmosphere of our sunlit side of our planet. It can affect things like certain specific radio frequency communication bands. And even more recently, it's launched these coronal mass ejections, a litany of them heading directly towards Earth. These explosive expulsions of solar material in strong magnetic fields that will eventually reach Earth. And the Space Weather Prediction Center of the National Weather Service has issued a G4. That's a severe or higher geomagnetic storm watch for the evening of May 10th going into a May 11th. That means infrastructure and technology may be impacted, including GPS accuracy. So all of you farmers out there that are trying to plant seeds right now, be aware your precision GPS systems may not function properly. And on a good note, Mother's Day weekend, there may be a fantastic Northern Light show just for you thanks to that. So, okay, turn it back to you. Wouldn't that be great if we could see more of that? Because you know how many times we've had to explain what a coronal mass ejection is? Thousands. At least you don't have to explain what a tornado is, right? People know it now. So imagine trying to talk this language. We really need your help to get smarter about this. Talk to us. Learn more. Broadcast it. Get the people familiar with it. Because this is what we're doing. We're focused not only on the forecast, watches, warnings, alerts, because we are the nation's official source for space weather forecasts and information. There's a misconception sometimes about where that comes from, but it's from us. This is what we're doing. Oh, by the way, this is not on Slack 2.0 or just be thankful for that. This is us calling on the phone. We do it old school, baby. We get on the phone and we call. Everything you're seeing here, notice on the bottom, that's the National Security Council in the White House Situation Room. They don't want to start to know about it when we get to that top end, that 5 level on our NOAA space weather scale. How many of you heard that the Biden administration was aware of that geomagnetic storm and monitoring the situation? Did anybody hear about that? Yeah, some of you did, I see. That's because we're telling them what's going on. Why? Because the nation wants to be ready, and we've been doing this work for the last 20 years to prepare for the storm that we just had. So if you happen to come to the NSUP sessions tomorrow, you'll hear about the effects that the infrastructure and technology we're dealing with and what we were doing to help mitigate that problem along with them. So a lot of details to come for tomorrow. That's because space weather impacts our way of life through the technology that we operate and rely upon. Whether it's rocket launches, satellite controllers trying busy during that last storm to keep satellites orbiting in the proper locations in space in those low Earth altitudes. We had aviation industry was diverting flights much more equatorward because they couldn't communicate via some of their communication band methods. GPS farmers trying to plant those crops that I mentioned. How great would they have loved to have known that from all of you, by the way, that that could have impacted their systems? Because what happened? Told you I've been in meteorology most of my life. I didn't tell you most of my life because I don't want to tell you how old I am. But nevertheless, this is the first time in my life I've ever gotten a space weather storm report from a family member. My brother-in-law called me up on Friday of the storms and said, "What the devil's going on here, Sean? My GPS system wasn't working today. I was off." He was supposed to be within centimeters. He was off by 12 feet. He said it was taking him in circles back and forth. He finally had to give up and suspend operations. He tried again the next day. It was working. But then I got another phone call that night. "When is this going to stop, Sean?" I said, even when the storms end, because they were so intense, our ionosphere, that outermost layer, can still be dramatically altered and still cause problems. That's why we do it at SWPC. Here's what you really need to be familiar with. start off with the NOAA Space Weather Scale stuff. It's three main categories. That 1 through 5 scale is designed that way to be like the hurricane scale. And it's focused on these three impact areas. The radiation storms that can affect human health, by the way. We're going back to the moon. You just heard about it. Guess what? We're going to have a forecaster or two deployed to Houston doing direct decision support for the benefit of the astronauts' safety on those missions. HF radio blackouts and, of course, the granddaddy that was talked about, geomagnetic storms. What we're forecasting and trying to predict is the underlying cause of those events that you see listed to the right, the solar energetic proton events that can penetrate into the electronics of satellites and cause problems, get into human tissue for aviators flying at high altitudes, especially near the polar regions. Flights will not fly those routes if we have extremely energetic events of that type going on because of the danger to human health that's going on here. Astronauts, they don't have protection out there in space. They'll have to take some pretty dramatic actions for 4 human beings crammed on a Orion capsule as they go back around the moon, hopefully a fall of next year. And then we have the coronal mass ejections that you just heard about, these CMEs. There's also the coronal holes that you heard about. Coronal holes are good to know for you as we get down away from solar max and towards solar minimum because they are a very good predictive factor about auroral activity and chances for seeing them. For broadcast meteorologists, any of you that are the northern tier of the country, you're probably more familiar with this for your viewing audiences, but you get the G1 on our scale or a G2. Certainly the northern lights become a chance to be seen in those sections of the country. We start talking to G3 at the strong levels. More sections of the United States are likely to be able to have a chance to see the aurora. And oh, by the way, some of the decision support we do, just so you know what's going on behind the scenes, at G3, we make a hotline call to most of the power grid of North America, letting them know about the chances for currents building up on their systems from space weather storms because we do not want to see a power blackout in this country, which is another reason so much has been invested over the last 2 decades of time in particular. And guess what? As you'll find out tomorrow, this was the most successfully mitigated extreme space weather storm in history thanks to those efforts and the outreach that's been done. Products to look for. Hey, we issue forecasts, just like any forecast office. We are the National Weather Service. We put out a 3-day forecast focused on those three NOAA Space Weather Scale areas. The geomagnetic storms, we try to break down in every 3 hours. Right? It's about as difficult to try to do as it is trying to forecast fog and IFR and low-level cloud conditions for aviation within a 30 minutes to an hour, right? Trying to do this for geomagnetic storms in 3-hour blocks is extremely difficult and even more so. But we do it. That's where you can find it on our webpage, under the products, under the 3-day forecast. Check it out. See what's going on. You don't have to know what all these what called KP index numbers mean on the side there, those 1 through 9 numbers. If it's a G-level event, geomagnetic storm, it's going to be in parentheses. So you'll see G1 off to the side or G3 and so on. And we also have a forecast discussion, just like the ones you are all intimately knowledgeable about. We do it for space weather. So if you want to understand what's going on and why we're predicting what we are, look at that 3-day forecast. This will also get you smarter to talk about space weather to your viewing audiences. You heard about the solar cycle. It's much more active than predicted. That maximum is going to be at some point this year, but that doesn't mean the activity shuts off. It doesn't work that way. We've got all of this year, all of next year, and even into 2026 that we will still be at risk for some of these larger coronal mass ejections and space weather storms before things really become settled down. We go back to that cue ball of a spotless sun during solar minimum. Coronal mass ejections, you've already seen some great imagery here. This is what we focus on at the Space Weather Prediction Center because this is the event when it arrives at Earth can it cause the most effects and impacts here. Dramatic imagery. We had similar events here for the May storms, especially the ones directed right towards Earth, as you heard about in my broadcast. Geomagnetic storms. That's what happens when they arrive at Earth. They get here, they smash into our protective magnetic barrier immediately, jolting the magnetometers that measure magnetic changes around our planet, spinning up currents that don't belong on there and direct current on AC alternating current high voltage transmission lines, among other impacts that it can happen immediately. As the storm progresses, this is where something becomes very important. And this is why we really struggle in this business and why I want you to know how difficult space weather forecasting is, because there's one element that we just never know. What is the orientation of the magnetic field going to be when it gets to Earth? We have no idea until it gets 1 million miles away. So it's already made that 92 million mile journey. Then we see it on spacecraft we have there, our buoy in space, monitoring the solar wind for the speed, density, temperature, and especially that magnetic field. So what you see, and you can find this all on our webpage, that top plot, that's the magnetic field strength. That white line represents the strength, which is usually around 5 nanotesla. You get to 10, all right, that's notable. You get to 20, probably reaching into some storm levels. You get above that, we're talking business here, activity at G3 or higher levels potentially. But the orientation has to be opposite Earth's magnetic field. So that red line, they call it the beta Z component, has to be minus, opposite Earth, so the magnets connect. Otherwise, we repulse, and we don't get that connection. That's why sometimes we can have a G3 forecast out, and nothing really happens. A lot of times, it's not only maybe because it missed us, because space weather forecasting is hard. We're trying to predict something from 93 million miles away, all right? Give us a break, for crying out loud. But then we don't know what that magnetic field orientation is until it gets here. So what happened on May 10th and 11th? You probably can't tell from your seats back there, but that's a dynamic scale. So the top end of that magnetic field strength is now 100. That's 10 to 12 times normal, the background strength of what we see out there. That is dramatic. That was 70-plus nanotesla. And by the way, look at that red line. It stayed south, minus almost the whole transpiration as that CME swathed over and it passed over Earth. That's why this was a global auroral event. People got to see it. They'll probably never see it again in their lifetime, and this went on for 24-plus hours. That's why you should all know about these things, because I guarantee your viewing audience is going to want to hear about it. How do you stay informed? You visit our webpage. I just talked about it. Most of our information is on there. You can get informed personally by email, by subscribing to product subscription services, and get what you want so you're alerted yourself to something to maybe research deeper into. And with that, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me, and I'm here throughout to answer your questions. Thanks.
All right, we do have time if anybody has one or two questions. Anybody? I will say while we're waiting that I found that very enjoyable because I remember living in Alabama during that last event. I was frantically checking the BZ and seeing how negative it was and also the KP index. And I think we went from like G4 to G5 in 2 seconds and everybody was like, oh, go outside, you can see it finally. And yeah, we saw the pink pillar. So it was amazing in Alabama.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Glad you were looking at it.
Anybody have a question? Sorry, okay, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Alex Swift, News 12 Long Island. Just a quick question, and thank you for the fantastic presentation. I was curious how or why the sun, you know, warms the Earth more during a maximum when you have all of these sunspots that are colder.
Yeah, there's research being done on that still, but there's no firm direct tie-in as of yet to climate change or any certainly not meteorological changes when it comes to sunspots and activity on the sun. So I can't really answer that in detail for you, but yeah, that's nothing that's been proven yet.
Hi, my name is Peyton. I go to the University of Oklahoma. I've started frequently visiting the Space Weather Prediction Center website more because I vividly remember a month ago when all this was happening, I was like, I don't understand space weather. Like, what is going on? Because I'm, like, trying to know, like, when can I see the Northern Lights and then also, like, post about it so other people know, hey, you can see the Northern Lights. And so just slowly learning about it, it's super interesting that you don't really learn about in school.
Well, thanks for that comment. Thanks for bringing that up. And, you know, just know you're going to hear about the Carrington event and the next thing and what that means. That's why our nation is so concerned. Not only so the viewing public can see the aurora, but what's going on behind the scenes is we're concerned about a massive power collapse in our country or around the world, which would be extremely disruptive and cost billions of dollars, let alone affect people's lives dramatically. Go ahead. Thanks.
When is the solar storm going to hit my house first? Because that's the question we're all going to get, right? But all kidding aside, are there any plans to put a satellite further out than just 1 million miles away from Earth between here and the sun so we have a better idea on that magnetism?
Thanks for asking that. Not necessarily closer to the sun, but we do have plans, and it's an international effort, to put a satellite kind of to the side of the sun. So we can see as the sun rotates what's about to come into view and also kind of get a better fix on where these CMEs are going, because we don't have Doppler shift capability out there in space, all right? We can see a massive full halo CME come from the sun, and this has happened twice already in the last month, and we think it's directed towards Earth because there's flaring going on, and then we realize through other information, no, it's backsided. It's going the other direction. So we need that kind of work in spacecraft out there.
All right, y'all two, the last two.
I'll just keep it quick. I get your daily email, the geophysical report, and you've mentioned a couple of the parameters in here, but there are others in here that, you know, like the solar wind, you know, what's normal? You give the solar wind speed, but is there a way to get us some information as to just all these parameters that we see in this and what's normal and what's, you know, because everything we deal with is based on normal temperatures and precipitation, things like that. Is there a way to get some of that? I'd like to understand this better.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Yeah. I'll certainly look and work into that, because we do need you to know what's normal. I mentioned about magnetic strength. What's normal? Just so you know, the background solar wind speed that's normal is about 300 to 400 kilometers per second. So we get to these 800 or 1,000 kilometers per second. That's pretty notable. So we will work to get more information out for the press and media. That's one of our goals over the next year and two.
Okay, real quick.
AJ Burnett from WCVB in Boston. Question for you is, in your opinion, is there an advantage, perhaps, now that we understand this a little bit better, to take our electrical, can you tell I speak for a living, by the way, electrical infrastructure and put it underground to protect it from these sorts of things? This is another reason for us to do that.
Well, unfortunately, unless they're really buried deep in the earth, they're still going to be prone to these geomagnetically induced currents, because it's really about the topography, the geology, how resistive is the rock that we live upon and what areas of the country. That's not only what, that's why some areas of the country are more prone to escalated levels of geomagnetic activity or experiences on their power, high voltage transmission lines, is because the rock is resistive, so they naturally find the current, the shortcuts to take a lot easier. And if they're underground, unless they're really deep, it's not going to make too much of a difference, because pipelines reside underground, and they're prone to these currents as well.
Thank
you. Thanks, everyone.
All right, so we do have a 30-minute presentation coming up, but Dave Jones is going to include some other people, so we're excited about his presentation as well. So Dave's going to be talking about a CME is headed for Earth. Are you ready to communicate potential impacts? All right. I'm sure you guys all know Dave, but here is Dave Jones.
Thanks, everybody. And by the way, Sean is also in this panel, so you'll get an extra dose of Sean. And he's sponsored by Copper Tone. So I thought I would start off just with some, before we get to our panelists, we have someone from NASA headquarters waiting to speak to us, and also from just outside of Washington, D.C., who's going to talk to us a little bit about critical infrastructure. But with this session, I had a little bit of news. We've heard so much about AI, right, and how AI is going to be so good for us, and I think it's really going to add value to a lot of you who do broadcast meteorology, and I'm going to I'll go to the next slide here, because I asked AI to create a TV meteorologist thinking about how to communicate a coronal mass ejection from the sun with a transparent background and solar flares and pointing at something. And I'll tell you why it's adding value to you, because this is what AI generated. No idea why the dude has a hat on, but if you notice, you're very, very efficient because you have three hands. So do not tell management that you have three hands, because they're going to put those to work too. Okay? So, yeah, thank you, AI. It's pretty awesome. So getting to the real panel here, panel discussion, we have three amazing people. You've experienced Sean, and you're going to get another dose. We have Dr. Madalika Guhathakurta from NASA headquarters. I'm going to describe Lika in just a second. And we also have Bob Koloski, who is a senior VP for Exeger. He does a lot of consulting with the utility industry. And Bob was a very instrumental figure in creating a division of DHS when he worked at Department of Homeland Security. So we're going to get right to Lika, because I know everybody has is on a time schedule. We call her Dr. Lika. Her name is Madhulika Guhathakurta. Call her Dr. Lika. And she is an amazing, amazing sheliophysicist. She's a sheliophysicist. And I have included a QR code for a podcast episode you might enjoy. So scan this, save it, listen to it later. It's about her talking with some other famous scientist. And Lika has led or been involved in the development of many incredible NASA missions, such as STEREO, SDO, Parker Solar Probe, Solar Orbiter, collaboration with the European Space Agency, and the Van Allen probes. In addition, Lika's been the program scientist for Voyager missions, ACE, which is the Advanced Composition Explorer, WIND, which is the wind measures properties of the electrically charged particles, known as the solar wind, and is one of the most successful and long-running space observatories, and SAMPEX, Solar Anomalous and Magnetic Particle Explorer. So Lika is joining us from Washington, D.C. Lika, I hope you can hear us. You can unmute. Please join us and say hello to your amazing fans that are here in the room.
Hello, everyone. You know, if you have had a 30-plus long career, everyone gets to do this. Thank you, Dave. Should I get started?
Yes, I think the floor is yours, Lika. Can you see your slides up?
I do. Thank you.
Awesome.
So, you know, the previous two speakers from Sky and Telescope and Space Weather Prediction Center, they have already given my talk. So I have to figure out, you know, what new addition I can bring to it.
Thank you very much, Lika. Our next speaker is...
Yeah, you could do that. But I do want to talk to you a little bit about the heliophysics. So don't come here yet. Stay on the first slide about heliophysics, you know, which is the science of space weather, space climate. And I want to kind of stretch our imagination a little bit more. Sun doesn't care that we are a planet and it has given us life. Sun sort of treats every planet, everything in the solar system the same way. So it's kind of worthwhile kind of thinking about what we are doing as a human species. So human civilization at this point has now extended from the physical domain of the Earth to the neighboring domain of the heliosphere. Space-based commercial and government infrastructure has grown so explosively in the past half century that satellites are starting to run into each other, and we know these are problems. Furthermore, humans have been living continuously in the heliosphere aboard International Space Station for nearly two decades, and this human presence is only increasing. So we are no longer simply observing some domain beyond our reach. We now must gain that level of understanding required to develop and inhabit a new environment. And this is the sun's environment. So what is space weather? It refers to magnetic disturbances and high radiation levels that result from solar activity. And, you know, auroras, power outages, radio blackouts are some of the manifestations we experience on Earth. Next, please. And so this is really showing the sun-Earth system. But this is also a prototype for studying other sun planet or other star planet system, stellar exoplanet system. This is not to scale very clearly, 93 million miles. The Earth orbits inside the atmosphere of the sun. So many of you who saw the total solar eclipse and the corona, we are embedded in the extended corona. In that sense, we truly are living with this star. So the sun is coupled to our planetary system and space by radiation, charged particles, and magnetic fields. Each one of these components will give rise to different manifestations of space weather. The study of heliophysics involves three forces. and their interaction. So it's pressure, gravity, and magnetic fields. For Earth weather, you know, there is no magnetic field, so the job is much simpler. Magnetic field is the key for space weather. In a way, you could think of heliophysics as an environmental science, a unique hybrid between meteorology and astrophysics. And as I said, it is also known as the science of space weather and space climate. Next, please. And so this is, there should have been sort of a heliophysics game changer. Maybe you took it out, Dave. You already knew. So that's fine. We will do this. Go to the next slide.
3 minutes, Lika.
What this is showing is sort of the complexity of the coupled processes. I showed you a simple Sun-Earth connection prototype, right, and showing the various activities of the Sun and how they are coupled. And this is giving you more details. You have heard about coronal mass ejections, coronal poles, interplanetary medium, energetic particles, and you are seeing with different colors where these phenomena are and how they are connected from Sun to interplanetary medium to our own planet. Next, please. This is the heliophysics game changers, and you can kind of cue in on all of this. So about 73, when we flew the Skylab experiment, which is the first solar laboratory in space, we came to kind of this realization that Sun impacts Earth, and it's only 73, think about that, that Sun impacts Earth with magnetic fields, radiation, and particles, which is mass. These are the things to remember. So the corona is hot and controlled by magnetic field, which generates X-rays and extreme ultraviolet variability at Earth, number one. Number two, high-speed solar wind originates from coronal holes. Solar particles impact Earth many deleterious ways, and you have heard some, you will hear some more. Most importantly, mass from the corona is ejected into interplanetary space. Solar catastrophic events can impact Earth's magnetosphere. We did not know anything about this until 73. This is the coronal mass ejection. Next, please. And so this is kind of a simple sketch of terrestrial space weather. What happens on the Sun to what happens on our planet, right? So solar flares happen, and that really causes radio blackouts, disturbances of the ionosphere caused by X-rays, emission from the Sun, as I had indicated before. Solar radiation storms, that's elevated levels of radiation that occur when number of energetic particles increase, coming often from high-speed wind in the coronal holes. And geomagnetic storms, these are disturbances in the geomagnetic field of Earth, caused by gusts in the solar wind, that blows by Earth, and often this is associated with coronal mass ejections. Next, please, and I'll give you a little bit more detailed version of that. And as you can see, all of this phenomenon, you can really blame it on the magnetic field of the Sun. If the Sun didn't have a variable magnetic field, then it would indeed be as boring a star that as astronomers would like to say it is. It's an ordinary star, but the most important to us. So extreme solar storms pose a threat to all forms of high technology. Anything with the on-off switch has the potential to be impacted. They begin with an explosion, a solar flare in the magnetic canopy of a sunspot often. X-rays and extreme ultraviolet radiation reach Earth at light speed, ionizing the upper layers of our atmosphere. And the side effects of this solar electromagnetic pulse include radio blackouts, GPS navigation errors. Minutes to hours later, as you can see, come the energetic particles because they have mass, so they cannot travel at the speed of light. So they move slightly slower, and they can electrify satellites and damage their electronics and all that. And then come the coronal mass ejections. billion ton clouds of magnetized plasma that take a day or more to cross the Sun-Earth divide. And if it's coming in a day, as we were hearing from Sean, you know something big is coming, something very energetic is coming. So we, by definition, will be on our guard. And so these are the consequences, as have been pointed out. This picture actually kind of gives you a sense of flares to energetic particles to CMEs and their association of the various R, S, and G scale that NOAA then puts out. Next, please. So this is our asset. We fondly call it Heliophysics System Observatory. It gives you a sense of the heterogeneous data we are collecting. We have about 20 operating missions with 27 spacecraft crisscrossing the distance from Sun to Earth and all the way to interstellar medium. But when we do the system science of heliophysics, we just do not look at NASA data only. We look at NOAA data, ground-based data, international data to really to put together a comprehensive picture, because our goal is to understand this environment and take it to the level of prediction from where NOAA can actually utilize that for forecast. And it's a very complicated system. Next, please. So in a way, I think where we are, if you look at the picture on the far right-hand corner, that is a model. It's called ENLIL model. It was originally developed by scientists, and now it is a predictive tool. And this model works with data like Solar Dynamics Observatory, like STEREO, because, you know, those are the ground truth validation. And it gives you a sense of the spread of coronal mass ejection across the solar system, because we have satellites not only at Earth, but all across the solar system. So it's important for us to keep track of that. Now, if CMEs are next, no, I haven't finished that.
Sorry, Lika, AI has taken over the presentation.
Yes, of course, my talk, I can totally understand. So the previous slide, I don't know if Dave can go back, but, you know, coronal mass ejections are detected by coronagraphs and are the primary driver of the most severe space weather events throughout the solar system, correct? And so the recent sort of leap in U.S. and international capacity to generate 1 to 3 day lead time space weather prediction is critically dependent on real-time coronagraph data and was aided hugely by STEREO, which actually went away from the Sun-Earth line to give us a full view of this. And so what I have done here, if you can play the two movies, Dave, below, just to kind of draw this out to show you the similarity between kind of what we are doing. This is like hurricane tracking, right? So weather in the Midwest today is Washington's weather tomorrow. Now, when you are doing meteorological prediction, you can do that. For us, it is the CME cloud that we are talking of. So coronal mass ejection tracking is essential for midterm forecasting, and I'm really excited about the GOZU launch and the compact coronagraph. Next, please. I think I'm coming to the close to the end. And so there's one more point I want to draw your attention to, is that space weather occurs at all phases of the solar cycle. Just because we draw solar cycle, you know, an X and Y scale, where maximum is the highest point on the Y axis and minimum is the lowest point on X axis, we often think all the bad things happen during solar max. Well, that's not true. Solar, space weather, different kinds of phenomena happen at both all phases and both extrema of the solar cycle. And you can see all of the various effects of both low sunspot number and high sunspot number. So during solar minimum, solar activity does not vanish. It just changes form. We have higher number of galactic cosmic rays, which can be really harmful. So in that sense, you know, solar La Nina, and these are kind of fun terms, don't take them too seriously, and solar La Nina are two sides of a great climate oscillation, not on Earth, but on the sun. And great rivers of plasma on the sun control both extremes of the solar cycle, solar max and solar min. Next, please. And this just simply shows that there is everyday space weather. You know, just like there is everyday weather, but we don't report on it, there is everyday space weather that we should not forget about. And so the white dot lines are basically the solar activity that is depicted by the total solar irradiance that we measure as a function of solar cycle over and over again, and that's what gives us the precise number of how much energy we are getting on Earth. You have the solar dynamics observatory images, and it, as a function of solar cycle, you can see that the surface of the sun in extreme ultraviolet is dimmer and gets peppered with brightness, you know, as it goes through the maximum. And along with that, along that same scale, this is cycle 2024, you can see auroral images taken from the International Space Station at different solar cycle stages. So the bottom line is that space weather is occurring at all times. And my last slide is actually a list of resources of all of our various missions that you can go to those websites and get a lot of really useful information. Thank you.
Great, thanks very much, Leka. Because we're on a time schedule here, you all know Sean. I'm going to invite Sean up because we talked before this panel discussion in over the last month or so, and you know, we said, look, you know, we had a very active event, May 11th. What does broadcast meteorologists, what do they understand, and what should they communicate when this happens? How many of you know, like you come in one day, let's just say in the Washington area the other day when there wasn't a tornado watch, and we had seven, or six. You know what to do because you're a meteorologist. When you come out and you hear there's a coronal mass ejection, do you know what to do? And as a station scientist, are you working at all with your station to make sure that you have things in place should you be the only station left on the air or whatever? So I'm going to throw it right to Sean so he can talk a little bit more detail about what SWPSE provides. And also, here's a little QR code of a interview that was just done with Sean on YouTube that you can scan and save and just refer to later so you have that information. So, Sean, thanks a lot for rejoining us. And floor is yours.
I don't have to explain anything now, right? You know it thanks to me. I can just talk terms and you're going to know what I'm talking about. But what would we like to see from the Space Weather Prediction Center? You all have a great relationship with the National Weather Service as a whole right now. You broadcast the message to your viewing audiences and the nation get a lot of their information, if not most of it, from you. Taking what the National Weather Service puts it out and getting it out there. We're set up the same way. We don't have that ability, but you do. So we would love to see more information about space weather so people get a chance to see something like the Northern Lights that maybe they'll never see again in their lifetime because of that extraordinary storm we had back in May. So with that said, what would my vision be for maybe a quick 90-second or so snippet on space weather in the broadcast media world? I'm not a broadcast meteorologist. I don't have that background. I do have a background in meteorology, so I speak your language. So forgive me for my faux pas, but let's give it a quick try here. All right, now turning to the sun. It's currently littered with many sunspots on the sun, including two massive regions to the northern and southern hemispheres of the sun right now. If we focus in on the southernmost one, region 3664, we can see the dynamic changes going on. It's become many times the size of Earth. It has grown in complexity, and it's become an increasing source of concern for space weather forecasters about the chances for solar storms. And indeed, it has been erupting with solar flares, those blasts of energy from the sun that immediately affect the outer atmosphere of our summit side of our planet. It can affect things like certain specific radio frequency communication bands. And even more recently, it's launched these coronal mass ejections, a litany of them heading directly towards Earth. These explosive expulsions of solar material in strong magnetic fields that will eventually reach Earth. And the Space Weather Prediction Center of the National Weather Service has issued a G4, that's a severe or higher geomagnetic storm watch, for the evening of May 10th going into a May 11th. That means infrastructure and technology may be impacted, including GPS accuracy. So all of you farmers out there that are trying to plant seeds right now, be aware your precision GPS systems may not function properly. And on a good note, Mother's Day weekend, there may be a fantastic Northern Light show just for you thanks to that. So, okay, turn it back to you. Wouldn't that be great if we could see more of that? Because you know how many times we've had to explain what a coronal mass ejection is? Thousands. At least you don't have to explain what a tornado is, right? People know it now. So imagine trying to talk this language. We really need your help to get smarter about this. Talk to us. Learn more. Broadcast it. Get the people familiar with it. Because this is what we're doing. We're focused not only on the forecast, watches, warnings, alerts, because we are the nation's official source for space weather forecasts and information. There's a misconception sometimes about where that comes from, but it's from us. This is what we're doing. Oh, by the way, this is not on Slack 2.0 or just be thankful for that. This is us calling on the phone. We do it old school, baby. We get on the phone and we call. Everything you're seeing here, notice on the bottom, that's the National Security Council in the White House Situation Room. They want to start to know about it when we get to that top end, that 5 level on our NOAA Space Weather Scale. How many of you heard that the Biden administration was aware of that geomagnetic storm and monitoring the situation? Did anybody hear about that? Yeah, some of you did, I see. That's because we're telling them what's going on. Why? Because the nation wants to be ready, and we've been doing this work for the last 20 years, to prepare for the storm that we just had. So if you happen to come to the NSUP sessions tomorrow, you'll hear about the effects that the infrastructure and technology we're dealing with and what we were doing to help mitigate that problem along with them. So a lot of details to come for tomorrow. That's because space weather impacts our way of life through the technology that we operate and rely upon. Whether it's rocket launches, satellite controllers trying busy during that last storm to keep satellites orbiting in the proper locations in space in those low Earth altitudes. We had aviation industry was diverting flights much more equatorward because they couldn't communicate via some of their communication band methods. GPS farmers trying to plant those crops that I mentioned. How great would they have loved to have known that from all of you, by the way, that that could have impacted their systems. Because what happened? Told you I've been in meteorology most of my life. I didn't tell you most of my life because I don't want to tell you how old I am. But nevertheless, this is the first time in my life I've ever gotten a space weather storm report from a family member. My brother-in-law called me up on Friday of the storms and said, "What the devil's going on here, Sean? My GPS system wasn't working today. I was off." He was supposed to be within centimeters. He was off by 12 feet. He said it was taking him in circles back and forth. He finally had to give up and suspend operations. He tried again the next day. It was working. But then I got another phone call that night. "When is this going to stop, Sean?" And said, even when the storms end, because they were so intense, our ionosphere, that outermost layer, can still be dramatically altered and still cause problems. That's why we would do it SWPSE. Here's what you really need to be familiar with. Start off with the NOAA Space Weather Scale stuff. It's three main categories. That 1 through 5 scale is designed that way to be like the hurricane scale. And it's focused on these three impact areas. The radiation storms that can affect human health, by the way. We're going back to the moon. You just heard about it. Guess what? We're going to have a forecaster or two deployed to Houston doing direct decision support for the benefit of the astronaut's safety on those missions. HF radio blackouts, and, of course, the granddaddy that was talking about, geomagnetic storms. What we're forecasting and trying to predict is the underlying cause of those events that you see listed to the right, the solar energetic proton events that can penetrate into the electronics of satellites and cause problems, get into human tissue for aviators flying at high altitudes, especially near the polar regions. Flights will not fly those routes if we have extremely energetic events of that type going on because of the danger to human health that's going on here. Astronauts, they don't have protection out there in space. They'll have to take some pretty dramatic actions for 4 human beings crammed on an Orion capsule as they go back around the moon, hopefully a fall of next year. And then we have the coronal mass ejections that you just heard about, these CMEs. There's also the coronal holes that you heard about. Coronal holes are good to know for you as we get down away from solar max and towards solar minimum, because they are a very good predictive factor about auroral activity and chances for seeing them. For broadcast meteorologists, any of you that are in the northern tier of the country, you're probably more familiar with this for your viewing audiences, but you get the G1 on our scale or a G2. Certainly the northern lights become a chance to be seen in those sections of the country. We start talking to G3 at the strong levels. More sections of the United States are likely to be able to have a chance to see the aurora. And oh, by the way, some of the decision support we do, just so you know what's going on behind the scenes, at G3, we make a hotline call to most of the power grid of North America, letting them know about the chances for currents building up on their systems from space weather storms, because we do not want to see a power blackout in this country, which is another reason so much has been invested over the last two decades of time in particular. And guess what? As you'll find out tomorrow, this was the most successfully mitigated extreme space weather storm in history, thanks to those efforts and the outreach that's been done. Products to look for. Hey, we issue forecasts, just like any forecast office. We are the National Weather Service. We put out a three-day forecast focused on those three NOAA space weather scale areas. The geomagnetic storms, we try to break down in every 3 hours. And it's about as difficult to try to do as it is trying to forecast fog and IFR and low-level cloud conditions for aviation within 30 minutes to an hour, right? Trying to do this for geomagnetic storms in three-hour blocks is extremely difficult, and even more so. But we do it. That's where you can find it on our webpage, under the products, under the three-day forecast. Check it out. See what's going on. You don't have to know what all these what called KP index numbers mean on the side there, those 1 through 9 numbers. If it's a G-level event, geomagnetic storm, it's going to be in parentheses. So you'll see G1 off to the side or G3 and so on. And we also have a forecast discussion, just like the ones you are all intimately knowledgeable about. We do it for space weather. So if you want to understand what's going on and why we're predicting what we are, look at that three-day forecast. This will also get you smarter to talk about space weather to your viewing audiences. You heard about the solar cycle. It's much more active than predicted. That maximum is going to be at some point this year, but that doesn't mean the activity shuts off. It doesn't work that way. We've got all of this year, all of next year, and even into 2026 that we will still be at risk for some of these larger coronal mass ejections and space weather storms before things really become settled down. We go back to that cue ball of a spotless sun during solar minimum. Coronal mass ejections, you've already seen some great imagery here. This is what we focus on at the Space Weather Prediction Center, because this is the event when it arrives at Earth can it cause the most effects and impacts here. Dramatic imagery. We had similar events here for the May storms, especially the ones directed right towards Earth, as you heard about in my broadcast. Geomagnetic storms. That's what happens when they arrive at Earth. They get here, they smash into our protective magnetic barrier, immediately jolting the magnetometers that measure magnetic changes around our planet, spinning up currents that don't belong on there, and direct current on AC alternating current high voltage transmission lines, among other impacts that can happen immediately. As the storm progresses, this is where something becomes very important. And this is why we really struggle in this business and why I want you to know how difficult space weather forecasting is, because there's one element that we just never know. What is the orientation of the magnetic field going to be when it gets to Earth? We have no idea until it gets 1 million miles away, so it's already made that 92 million mile journey. Then we see it on spacecraft we have there, our buoy in space, monitoring the solar wind for the speed, density, temperature, and especially that magnetic field. So what you see, and you can find this all on our webpage, that top plot, that's the magnetic field strength. That white line represents the strength, which is usually around 5 nanotesla. You get to 10, all right, that's notable. You get to 20, probably reaching into some storm levels. You get above that, we're talking business here. Activity at G3 or higher levels potentially, but the orientation has to be opposite Earth's magnetic field. So that red line, they call it the beta Z component, has to be minus, opposite Earth, so the magnets connect. Otherwise, we repulse and we don't get that connection. That's why sometimes we can have a G3 forecast out and nothing really happens. A lot of times it's not only maybe because it missed us, because space weather forecasting is hard. We're trying to predict something from 93 million miles away, all right? Give us a break, for crying out loud. But then we don't know what that magnetic field orientation is until it gets here. So what happened on May 10th and 11th? You probably can't tell from your seats back there, but that's a dynamic scale. So the top end of that magnetic field strength is now 100. That's 10 to 12 times normal, the background strength of what we see out there. That is dramatic. That was 70-plus nanotesla. And by the way, look at that red line. It stayed south, minus almost the whole transpiration as that CME swathed over and it passed over Earth. That's why this was a global auroral event. People got to see it. They'll probably never see it again in their lifetime, and this went on for 24-plus hours. That's why you should all know about these things, because I guarantee your viewing audience is going to want to hear about it. How do you stay informed? You visit our webpage. I just talked about it. Most of our information is on there. You can get informed personally by email, by subscribing to product subscription services, and get what you want so you're alerted yourself to something to maybe research deeper into. And with that, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me, and I'm here throughout to answer your questions. Thanks.
All right, we do have time if anybody has one or two questions. Anybody? I will say while we're waiting that I found that very enjoyable because I remember living in Alabama during that last event. I was frantically checking the BZ and seeing how negative it was and also the KP index. And I think we went from like G4 to G5 in 2 seconds and everybody was like, oh, go outside. You can see it finally. And yeah, we saw the pink pillars. So it was amazing in Alabama.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I'm glad you were looking at it.
Anybody have a question? Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Alex with News 12 Long Island. Just a quick question, and thank you for the fantastic presentation. I was curious how or why the sun, you know, warms the Earth more during a maximum when you have all of these sunspots that are colder.
Yeah, there's research being done on that still, but there's no firm direct tie-in as of yet to climate change or any certainly not meteorological changes when it comes to sunspots and activity on the sun. So I can't really answer that in detail for you, but yeah, that's nothing that's been proven yet.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Peyton. I go to the University of Oklahoma. I've started frequently visiting the Space Weather Prediction Center website more because I vividly remember a month ago when all this was happening, I was like, I don't understand space weather. Like, what is going on? Because I'm, like, trying to know, like, when can I see the Northern Lights? And then also, like, post about it so other people know, hey, you can see the Northern Lights. And so just slowly learning about it, it's super interesting that you don't really learn about it in school.
No, thanks for that comment. Thanks for bringing that up. And, you know, just know you're going to hear about the Carrington event and the next thing and what that means. That's why our nation is so concerned. Not only so the viewing public can see the aurora, but what's going on behind the scenes is we're concerned about a massive power collapse in our country or around the world, which would be extremely disruptive and cost billions of dollars, let alone affect people's lives dramatically. Go ahead. Thanks.
When is the solar storm going to hit my house first? Because that's the question we're all going to get, right? But all kidding aside, are there any plans to put a satellite further out than just 1 million miles away from Earth between here and the sun so we have a better idea on that magnetism?
Thanks for asking that. Not necessarily closer to the sun, but we do have plans, and it's an international effort, to put a satellite kind of to the side of the sun so we can see as the sun rotates what's about to come into view and also kind of get a better fix on where these CMEs are going, because we don't have Doppler shift capability out there in space, all right? We can see a massive full halo CME come from the sun, and this has happened twice already in the last month, and we think it's directed towards Earth because there's flaring going on, and then we realize through other information, no, it's backsided. It's going the other direction. So we need that kind of work in spacecraft out there.
All right. Y'all two, the last two.
I'll just keep it quick. I get your daily email, the geophysical report, and you've mentioned a couple of the parameters in here, but there are others in here that, you know, like the solar wind, you know, what's normal? You give the solar wind speed, but is there a way to get us some information as to just all these parameters that we see in this and what's normal and what's, you know, because everything we deal with is based on normal temperatures and precipitation, things like that. Is there a way to get some of that? I'd like to understand this better.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Yeah. I'll certainly look and working into that because we do need you to know what's normal. I mentioned about magnetic strength, what's normal. Just so you know, the background solar wind speed that's normal is about 300 to 400 kilometers per second. So we get to these 800 or 1,000 kilometers per second. That's pretty notable. So we will work to get more information out for the press and media. That's one of our goals over the next year and two.
Okay, real quick.
AJ Burnett from WCVB in Boston. Question for you is, in your opinion, is there an advantage, perhaps, now that we understand this a little bit better, to take our electrical infrastructure and put it underground to protect it from these sorts of things? This is another reason for us to do that.
Well, unfortunately, unless they're really buried deep in the earth, they're still going to be prone to these geomagnetically induced currents, because it's really about the topography, the geology, resistive is the rock that we live upon and what areas of the country. That's why some areas of the country are more prone to escalated levels of geomagnetic activity or experiences on their power, high voltage transmission lines, is because the rock is resistive, so they naturally find the current, the shortcuts to take a lot easier. And if they're underground, unless they're really deep, it's not going to make too much of a difference, because pipelines reside underground and they're prone to these currents as well. Thanks, everyone.
That's great. Thanks, Sean. I'm going to call an audible here because we're under a little bit of a time constraint. And I'm going to show you the introductory slide for Bob Kolosky, but I'm not going to go to Bob Kolosky because we have a much more important conversation. No, I'm kidding. He had to leave. He had a hard stop, so he's not with us anymore. But here's a CNN op-ed that Bob wrote during that May 11th event that we had. So I encourage you to scan it, take a look at it, and read it later, because he talks about impacts to critical infrastructure and how vulnerable we are and our grid is. But I did want to start to maybe engage your thoughts. So if you have questions, please come up to the microphone. And one of the ones I had for Sean is, I was thinking, and Paul Gross, you had a question before about, there you are, about, what do these terms mean? And, everybody reads the AFDs, when you're talking about making a forecast, putting the forecast discussion together, and you're reading the Weather Service. The Space Weather Prediction Center does a similar type of discussion. But in those forecast discussions, you see hyperlinks on terms that you can click on and understand what those terms are. But I don't think there are hyperlinks in any of the discussion terms. So I'm wondering if that's something that you can either take back with you, you've thought about, or something like that, that could really help the broadcast Mets really dive in. Because, we're headed towards the solar max in 2025. A lot of solar activity. You don't want to be caught off guard again. How can you be dialed into more of what you're thinking?
Yeah, thanks. That's a very good point. I brought that up a couple of years ago, actually, but it's nothing we followed up on. It's kind of fell down low on the priority poll. But with this event we just had and the fact that we're trying to engage with the press and media so much more to help get you more space weather ready, just like you are weather ready, obviously, right? Because we want the nation to be space weather ready. It's a big goal of ours. So I'll take that back again, and we'll start to see if we can maybe start just make some links for some of these terms you're seeing. We do have a glossary on our webpage, so you'd have to go find it yourself right now, but these terms are out there. And Dave, one thing I'll bring up really quick that I probably should is I'm hoping some of you will come to me and give me your contact information. The reason is the Science and Technology and Policy Institute, STPI, we call them for short, of the government, we're revising the NOAA Space Weather Scales. We want to make them better and more relevant to today. And now that we're engaging the broadcast media world, they want your opinion. So any of you that are already a little smarter on this NOAA Space Weather Scales and what they might mean for you, please come to me because they're looking for some points of contact, and I want to bring them back some names so they can contact you to help you be involved to improve this NOAA Space Weather Scales. Thanks.
Time for question? Yes, sir.
Yeah, great talk. Hey, Sean, you talk about, we're sort of on the weather end of it. You're on the space end of it. And, if we're to have sort of a Carrington event, and it's possible perhaps in 25, when we're out there talking about, hey, batteries and, your credit cards might not work and all that sort of thing, we understand if you tell me a major hurricane's coming, we can kind of get an idea, all right, how long is the power going to be out? Is there any way on your end of actually predicting what this disruption or impact could mean to the real public so that on our end, we can kind of relay that information, knowing there's a little more, you know, it's a little more touch and go for us. This is not our area of expertise.
Right. Yeah, thanks. There's no way for us at the Space Weather Prediction Center to predict that. That's really the power grid's going to be dealing with that potentiality. But yes, the concern is it's not going to be a power outage over a segment of a community or a county or perhaps even just a state. We're talking states in coverage here if we had a major collapse. So that's disrupting power lights, water, communications, everything you just talked about because there's no power to operate them. Cell phone towers will eventually run out of power with their backup generators and stuff. It would be devastating if we had that. We hope, like to think that that will not happen, but the potential is there when it comes to this Carrington benchmark event because we know that that level could be concerning. And just as a teaser for tomorrow, I was told by the Department of Energy that this event that we just had, if it had been, say, a terrestrial weather event, like a major heat wave going on at the same time, there were some concerns of whether or not they'd been able to keep the grid stable in that area of that heat wave. So just an idea there of terrestrial weather combined with space weather can make it mutually and even more of a problem.
That's great. Thanks, everybody. We appreciate your attention during this session.
All right, guys, don't go anywhere. We are opening the exhibit hall in about 15 minutes, and before we do that, we want to allow all the we want to allow the exhibitors to come up and each give a little three-minute spiel of what you can expect from their booth. We don't have time to take questions from them, but you don't need to ask them questions here when you can ask them questions downstairs at their booth. So if they could all come up and be ready to go so that we can get down, because the food's coming out in about 14 minutes, and we don't want to have cold food, right? So. All right, first up we have Stephen Cruz from Gray Television. Is Stephen here? Stephen
Cruz.
Gray Television?
All right.
All right, moving on.
All right, he's not here. Ken Brewer? All right.
I know Ken.
Okay, while they're uploading the presentation, just a couple of quick notes. Of course, our exhibit hall and reception is going to be downstairs in the Atlantic Room, so there's that. Also, if you're interested in getting a briefing from one of our students, they are going to be doing a briefing at 8:15 tomorrow morning and on Friday morning of Myrtle Beach weather. And also, our sessions are beginning at 8:30 tomorrow. And I think that's it. We're going to be separating tomorrow because today was the joint session, so all of the weathercom side is going to be in that room, I believe, right? Yeah, that room right next door. So weathercom over there, broadcast side over here, but you're free to bounce back and forth and go to whichever presentations you'd like. All right, Ken Brewer, take it away.
Hi there, thank you. Okay, as mentioned, we have 3 minutes of time. So basically what I wanted to do with this time is just kind of talk about some of the things that have happened at Barron since we last saw you in Phoenix and some new products that we have for our clients that are out there and available now to be able to be used. One of those is automated flight delays. So basically any airport that has an airline flight that goes into it in the United States or even Southern Canada, we have airport delay information that comes up with that. We also store 6 hours of data for that. So you can tell stories if there are squall lines that come through and you have airports that have delays for a while and then they get back up online and moving again, that you'll be able to show those then. And a bunch of different information about different reasons why you have flight delays that are going on. We also provide templates for you on both map-based and studio-based frames if you want them to look like billboards that show up at airports with the flight delay information, different types of weather information that kind of goes along with that also. Flooding information. So we've incorporated at Barron all the flood information from all the flood gauges across the country. You can display those in map versions, and we have templates for those that will have backgrounds that change colors based on the different flood thresholds that you see from the flood stages across the country. And then we also have mediogram versions of this. The thing that we like most about this is all this is 100% automated. You basically enter the gauge, all the data in all the stages automatically populates. So you don't spend 3 hours trying to build river gauges across your area. You can just basically within 10 or 15 seconds get a flood gauge and get the mediogram information to pop up with that in there. So again, map versions of that and what we call studio or full screen frames of that that will update the forecast river levels that kind of go along with that. And we also have different versions of that. We know that basically there's a lot of gauges across the country that will have current river gauge data, but not necessarily forecast data that comes along with it. So we built two different types of templates, one for those current-based river data, and then one that have forecast plots that are go along with that as well. And also want to talk about, we have an ability to use user data interface. So if you want to incorporate CSV data files or GeoJSON-based files within links, we now have a server that you can be able to do that, to plot those on a map, or you can be able to have that data that automates in the studio as well. So if you want more information on that, our booth is downstairs. We'll be able to, happy to show you that. And if you're a current client and want to get signed up for that, we can get you information on that. And if you're not even a client, you just want to take a look around and stuff, come visit us. We'll be happy to talk to you. Happy to see you. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much, Ken, from Barron Weather. Now we have Bruce Jones from NOAA Weather Radio.
Is our projector still on? Guess what I'm going to talk about? I think this year is my 50th year in broadcasting, so that includes 2 years on college radio, but yeah, 50 years, and thank you. But all along, I've been saying, you know, I have multiple redundant ways to get your warnings, and that includes NOAA Weather Radio. In fact, President Gerald Ford was the first one to talk about this, and then Bill Clinton was a big supporter of NOAA Weather Radio. In fact, next year marks the 50th anniversary of Gerald Ford designating NOAA Weather Radio as America's official federal warning system, which it still is. So they'll have a big 50th anniversary next year. But encourage your viewers to have multiple redundant ways to get these warnings, because any system can fail. The NOAA Weather Radio Network now comprises 1,033 transmitters. They're getting ready to put a couple of new ones in the panhandle of Texas up around Dalhart, which hasn't been served very well in the past. The NOAA Weather Radio Modernization Act passed the House and the Senate recently. And amongst the portions of that bill is to harden the NOAA Weather Radio transmitters for electromagnetic pulse, so that in the event of a Carrington event, these NOAA Weather Radio transmitters would stay on the air and still be able to provide the significant life-saving information that the nation would need when we have a widespread hit to our power and utility grid. Partial county alerting is being instituted next year. This is the year where the emergency managers are meeting with the National Weather Service to decide should our county be partitioned or not. The first digit of an SAME code has traditionally been a zero, but you can put other digits in there and partition the county into smaller segments. And tomorrow, Doug Bryson, the emergency manager from Spartanburg County, South Carolina, he and I will be giving a presentation. We'll talk a little bit about how he may be partitioning his county. Not all counties will be partitioned. We have a new version of our weather radio that includes these partition identifiers in there, northwest, north central, northeast, and I've got permission to give away 100 or 200 of them, but we'll mail them to you. So come by the Midland booth and sign up, and when these new radios arrive here in about 3 more weeks, you'll get a copy of the new WR120 DSP, and we'll just mail it out to your